position number 21613, wheel 5.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with cheetah David Coburn Salmon in his home on the 20th of the 3rd, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. You were talking about Tobruk, and I wanted to know whether you were actually in Tobruk when air raids took place.
No, not in the town, no. Mm. No, I wasn't, no. Never actually, the time that we went in, there wasn't an air raid.
Did you understand the sort of setup of the place, how it was operating under these trying circumstances?
Not really, no. No, we weren't really in touch with much of that. Because they had a small hospital in there of a sort, and it was sort of a clearing station, really.
Did you go in there? You mentioned that you had desert sores at one point. Did you go in?
No, never were lucky enough to go into hospital for desert sores. We just put up with those.
So going into hospital was seen as a
oh yes, good luck. Well, it is. If you were going to hospital there, you were going to Alexandria. You know, the minor things were all attended to as a first aid post.
And what were they like in the desert?
Oh, just a tent. Yeah, just tents. Tents set back. And often they came under fire, but
intentionally?
No, not intentionally. Just carryover, really, because there's no way that anybody could recognise them as being first aid posts, so the enemy would be able to recognise that. It's just that they were close enough to get hit. But if you've ever been back behind the battle, it's worse than in front of it, going forward, I think.
Tell us why.
Well, you go back and see the carnage that's left. I mean, everybody else is moving on, and what's left is behind you. And it's not very, that's not very pleasant at all. Mm-hmm. Now, I've experienced one case going back, and there were blokes lying, some with legs off and arms off, and, you know, screaming to you to come and help them. But in my particular case, I couldn't do anything. I just had to keep going on this particular time. And that's a very unpleasant experience. Because it takes time for the stretch of bearers to, you know, in the battle to get to people. And yes, behind the battle's not good. If you've ever seen a tank after it's been hit, that's another nasty thing. Because the shells go inside and they go round and round inside. The shell gets in and it goes, penetrates and goes round and round and makes it a very nasty mess indeed. Mm. I always had great admiration for tank people because it could be very nasty. Fire was another nasty thing with tanks. But, oh no, a lot of bad things. Mm. But it's hard to describe, and this for people who've been there, they really don't. It's very hard for them to visualise it, I think.
Being in a frontline situation like you were in Tobruk, was that, you know, you were on the defensive in that situation, not actually moving forward. Did that make things more difficult when you were surrounded by your mates in wounded situations?
No, I think although you were on the defensive, you were in a defensive, but you were also in an attacking position. You weren't just, it's hard to explain, but you did attacking as well. Although you were defending somewhere, you were also attacking. And although you didn't get, your attacking was for a limited distance, it was still, you still felt that you were aggressive. You weren't just sitting ducks waiting to be taken.
You mentioned that earlier on with the patrols, the sort of an attacking defence.
Yes, well that you felt that, and Moorshead was very strong on these patrols. He was a great one for keeping patrols going, keeping the enemy on their seat and on their mettle all the time. And,
you mentioned going into Tobruk, the town. What was the atmosphere of the place? You mentioned that the buildings, a lot of the buildings were blown up, but what was the actual feeling once you got there?
Oh, I don't know, really. It was just, you were just in a really wrecked sort of a town, and you didn't really see anybody much except the blokes you were with and the ship that you were unloading and those that were sort of carting it away. But you didn't have time to wander around, have a look and speak to anybody else that was domiciled in the town itself. You didn't have time for anything like that. So you really didn't get a very good impression of what morale was, but I'm sure it was good in the town.
Were there times when you were given relief from the front line? And if so, what did that include?
Well, all you went back to a second line of defence, that was all. And when you're in the second line of defence, you probably weren't involved in patrols. You were just a defence, second defence. But you didn't get showers or baths or anything like that. Many, many weeks without any washing. I used to keep enough out of my water bottle just to clean my teeth, that was all. And of course everybody smelt together, so you didn't really notice anybody else. It's an extraordinary thing, that. You really don't. You don't notice. We all must have smelt like I don't know what. But you didn't notice it. Funny.
So what's it like to have that first shower or bath or swim in the ocean?
Well, the first thing we had was when they brought up some drums of salt water. And we managed to have some of that at one stage. I can't just remember when that was, but I think it must have been when we were in second line of defence. And then that was really the only water we ever had for washing was salt water. We never got to the sea in Tobruk. We did later at Alamein, we got to the sea and had a bath. But it didn't work. It was just... you just got enough water to drink, or barely enough to drink. No, it was very monotonous.
So in the second line of defence, did you have time to sort of lighten up a bit?
Oh, I suppose you did, yes, I suppose you did, really.
And what did that entail?
Well, I suppose you just relaxed more. You didn't tail better position, better conditions or anything like that. It was just a matter of slightly less pressure, because you never knew at any moment when you were going to be called on to get involved in something. But no, relaxation was just what you made it, I think. You know, perhaps a pack of cards or something like that.
Did you become a good card player in Tobruk?
Well, I played a bit of bridge. A little bit.
You mentioned also, the air attacks you were to experience. You had no cover in the desert situation. What was it like to be attacked in front line by incoming
planes? Well, the air attacks in Tobruk were pretty few and far between. The air attacks we experienced were more at Alamein. The air attacks in Tobruk were mainly directed at the shipping. They didn't really attack the front line with aircraft. Certainly not where we were. And I don't think I ever remember anybody experiences an air attack in an attack in Tobruk. It was all tank work and artillery. But there was no air cover, of course. It didn't have any air protection. But I think the Germans, I suppose, they considered cutting our lifeline was more important than anything, so they concentrated on that.
To what extent was the cause of keeping Tobruk a stronger and more strengthening cause than possibly the Germans had of taking the place?
Well, I think I think holding Tobruk for a lot of the time was pretty imperative, because it gave the Egypt a chance, the forces in Egypt a chance to build up. Had we not been there, Rommel would have been a... See, Rommel could have concentrated a much bigger part of his force on the line at of Egypt than he was able to with us there in Tobruk. And that was the whole object of it, really. And we'd hoped that they'd have been able to drive up from Egypt and relieve us, but that never came. That didn't ever happen, of course.
Do you think that was partly the reason why Tobruk was never taken, that the Germans had an eye on somewhere else all the time?
Well, I think all the time Rommel was intended to take Tobruk, but he didn't take it until after we'd left, and that was something that hurt the Australians more than you can possibly imagine.
Why was that such a strong feeling for you once you'd heard it been taken?
Well, I think that you cannot imagine what happened when the news came through to us when we were in Lebanon that Tobruk had fallen with hardly a shot being fired. You can't imagine. I think the troops were at that stage looking forward to coming back, because they felt they were going to come back to Australia, defend Australia. But I think that when they heard that Tobruk had fallen without a shot, they were then prepared to stay in Africa and fight the thing out, because it was something they couldn't believe, really, that after all that time that we defended it, that it should fall so easily. And why that is, I don't know. Why it fell so easily, I really don't know, but it did. And it'll always be a thorn in the side of those who served there that more of a fight wasn't put up. But I don't know that you can blame, whether you can blame the troops, but whether it was the fault of the garrison, or whether it was Rommel was much stronger and didn't, I don't know really.
You mentioned also that you were relieved. I mean, obviously you weren't in Tobruk when it did fall. When did the relief come about? You mentioned sometime in August. How did that come about? What was the purpose of you being relieved?
Well, the purpose of us being relieved, really, was to come back to... Well, I think they had to bring the troops out, because they were pretty... Most of the physical side of people was getting pretty bad. People really suffered, you know. And when you actually got back out of Tobruk, you suddenly noticed that the fellows around you were thin, and they were covered in sores, and they were... When we got back, actually, to the to Palestine, many had to go out and buy just whatever clothing they could, because we didn't get anything from the Q stores. And we didn't get anything from the Q stores until a message got through that Blamey was coming to inspect us, and then we got them. In the meantime, they were literally in rags, sort of, because we'd worn these clothes for months. And,
tell us about departing, what the process was.
Departing from Tobruk. Well, we were just loaded onto destroyers. And
was there any risk that you might be bombed on
the
way
out? Oh, yes. A lot of bombed or torpedoed or anything could happen. Yeah, oh, yes. Oh, yes, the Germans could have caught up with you. They'd have been on you like a ton of bricks.
What was the feeling then?
Oh, I think there was great relief that we were getting out at that stage. Definitely was, and because some of our chaps were left behind, there were some that were left behind to steer the incoming troops in, and it wasn't a very happy moment for them to have to stay, but of course they came out eventually. But
what was the feeling then of having to leave Tobruk, a place that you'd been for so long, before the job was finished, really?
Well, I suppose it was, in a way there was disappointment, but in another way there was relief, I think, because everybody was getting to the stage where they, they needed to get out and to get into decent food and decent conditions for a time, because we'd just been, it was a very harsh condition in Tobruk, which is understandable because the supply line was so, you know, and everybody had been on pretty ordinary sort of rations and just needed the break. So I think everybody was tired and ready to get a nice hot bath or whatever.
So you were brought back to Palestine, am I right?
Yes, we came back to camp Kilo 89, which where we came back from Tobruk, and that's where we sort of had a bit of a rest, and we had a little bit of leave before we moved to up to Lebanon.
What was the condition like at
Kilo 89? Oh, quite good. Oh, quite good there. We got quite good food and a little bit of leave.
What did you do on your leave?
Oh, I went to Jerusalem one day, and one leave I went to Cairo. And,
what were those experiences like, having been in battle?
Oh, very good, very, very pleasant. I thoroughly enjoyed Jerusalem. It was a fascinating place, and Egypt was too. Egypt was fascinating.
Have you been back since?
No, I haven't been back. I'd like to go back to Egypt.
Tell us about the experience that you had in Egypt.
Well, we went to, a lot of us went on leave. We got into a good hotel, and we had some good food, good drinks, and a lot of sightseeing. But when my brother-in-law, he was in the unit, when he was there, King Farouk was playing up a bit, and he was, of course, he was very pro-German, and David had to go in with the, he was at the officers' corps in Cairo, and he had to go in, and they went in with tanks, and they knocked down the gates of the palace, and the British ambassador went in, and he was confronted with the fact that he either did this or he was out. And that was quite an experience for David, quite interesting.
Were you in touch with your brother?
Yes, oh, he was in the same unit. This is my brother-in-law.
To be,
he wasn't then. Oh, yes, we were, and it was pretty interesting. But Farouk had a lovely wife, Farida. Lovely, you know. I remember going, we went to the opera house to a big charity show there while we were on leave, and I always remember her arriving, and then I can remember the British ambassador arriving in this, his big roles, and wasn't much doubt as to who was ruling Egypt.
What sort of things did they say to you?
What, the Egyptians?
Both.
Oh, well, of course we didn't come in contact much with the educated Egyptians, and I don't think the other ones would have sort of taken much notice, but quite a glittering affair this was that we went to. Beautiful opera house. And we went to the races, one night to the races. That was interesting. All the pashas with their horses. But Egypt was fascinating in those days. I can remember on the troop train drawing up the station once, and the train going on the other way, I think it was going from Cairo to Alex, it had the carriage on it, one of the pashas' carriages, and it was all lit up, and we were in the troops, and you could look through, and you have no idea what it was like. All these beautiful, great, huge bowls of flowers, and it was magnificent. And they used to attach the pashas' carriages to the trains in their own private carriages. And on it was amazing too. On the stations, you'd see a lot of well-educated Egyptian women, and they were dressed in European clothes. And all they had was they used to just pull across their face. But they were in European dresses, the well-educated ones. And there's some beautiful parts of Cairo, of course, lovely suburbs, the better two suburbs, but a lot of poverty.
What was What was it like to be a soldier, sort of suddenly transported from a battle situation to now being a sort of tourist in a place like Cairo?
Yes, it's quite a difference. Yeah. No, I think. Well, I suppose it was like going into a different world, wasn't it? But no, the Egyptian people, of course, were funny sort of people. But the poor people there in those days were very poor. You know, all the villages were really just mud brick houses. And the Fellaheen were poor. But I enjoyed Egypt.
Did you see the pyramids?
Yes, and I did something which you can't do today. I climbed up through the centre of the pyramid into the king's and queen's chambers. And that has all since been closed. You can't do that now because the tourists were doing too much damage to the... But it was just a little passage that went up and you had with a sort of funny sort of steps on it. And you just went got up and into it. Of course, there were no mummies or anything there. They were all in the museum, of course. It was just... You could see where they'd been laid, that's where the mummies had been taken from. But fascinating. Mm. Amazing place, those pyramids.
Did you go with other comrades?
Yes, other comrades, yeah. Yeah. And I never forget, too, they used to... We got some camels to ride there. And I can always remember there was a chap who was... you know, you're always worried by these people. They were always coming and asking you to do, did you want this and did you want to buy that and had you got any money? And I said to this chap when he came, I said, Imshi. And that meant buzz off. But he got very offended about it. He said, you know, he said, that's very rude. Because I apologised to him and we finished up getting taken back to his house. And he really was quite a nice chap. And, you know, it was quite an experience to go into his home. But we had camels to ride, you go around the pyramids and just for a bit of fun. Oh, it was a lot of fun, Lee. But you can't imagine how the desert... How the fertile land ends in Egypt, and then the desert's almost like walking out that front door onto desert. It's extraordinary. It was in those days.
The situation at the time wasn't looking amazing for the Allies. How easy was it to relax?
No, well, I think it was a little bit of a dead time there because otherwise we wouldn't have been doing what we were doing. I think that the line was being held. And the pressures hadn't really built up to what was going to come later. And I think that enabled us to... It was a slightly quiet time then. And I suppose Rommel was building his forces up and our own people were trying to do the same. Mm. But
you were mentioning hearing about Tobruk being taken.
Mm.
Had you heard about the loss in Greece?
I think we probably had then. I think we probably had, yes. But I can't just remember whether we had at that particular time or not.
I'm interested to know what the general feeling amongst the average Allied soldier was towards the general situation.
Well, I don't think we were ever particularly worried about it. No. I don't think we were worried, no. I think it was a sort of... confidence. People had a confidence that we were going to be, you know, come through in the end. Mm. I don't think there was ever any despondency at all. Well, I never experienced it.
Mm. You mentioned that you went to Lebanon. Tell us about that situation.
Well, we went to Tripoli, which is quite a big town in Lebanon. It's probably very much bigger today. And we were up in the mountains above Tripoli. And we were building a defensive line there against any advance which the Germans might make through Turkey. It was Turkey they were worried about. And they were also a bit worried that they might make an airborne landing. So we dug defensive positions up there and we got in training, different sorts of different type of training. We escorted trains up to the border taking arms to Russia, which a lot of people don't realise how much stuff was given to Russia, and I don't think Russia ever acknowledged much of it either. But, you know, lots of tanks and all sorts were going up on these goods trains. We used to have to get off. We had a platoon. We had to get off every time the train stopped and patrol it to see nobody could interfere with the train.
As I understand, that was part of the reason why there were problems in the desert for Rommel, that there was more of an interest of the Germans toward Russia than there was anywhere else, really, at that point.
Yes, well, it had to be, I think, And I think Rommel was trying to get more troops and more supplies. He had to push very hard for that. But it was quite an interesting time in Lebanon. We got leave. We got leave to into Beirut, and we also had Tripoli leave. And everybody was starting to get their health back, you know, again. Good food. And then, of course, became the Homs Desert, which is really a jock column exercise. And the Homs Desert is really it's in Syria, and it's right up near the Turkish border, and it is unbelievably hot. When we were on these exercises, we had 2 weeks of it, and we were thirstier then than we ever were in Tobruk. It was just diabolical. And actually, we believe that the high command was trying to train people to go without water. No, you can't train people to go without water. When you have to go without water, you go without it. And anyhow, the CO in the end broke. He wasn't going to. He disregarded this order, and he sent trucks out to the Arab wells, and we got water out of the wells, where Arab wells, it was all boiled up, and we got a little bit of extra water. But all it was, and I had whooping cough. And all I could do, it was immense heat, was every time the jock column stopped, I climbed out of the truck and got underneath and lay in the shade of the truck. And then when we had to start up again, and of course nobody knew what I had. It wasn't until everything was over and we got back that they realised I'd had whooping cough. But anyhow, we also had a big manoeuvre up there when all the Allied commanders came from Egypt to witness what was happening, because we were put in a defensive role and we had to defend ourselves against attack by tanks, in a training episode. Because what they were trying to find out was whether it was still possible to stop tanks with artillery and infantry. And they became convinced that it was. And because of what they learnt on that exercise, they used that a lot at Alamein. And that was quite interesting too, the result of that. We didn't realise that even that they were there at that time. Of course, we're troops, but they were, and they were observing it. And I believe they were covered in dust, and they looked. You couldn't tell the senior officers from anybody else. They were all so dirty. No, but it was. We served a good purpose in that, but we had another week after the fortnight with all these senior personnel there. We had to go through it all again. Not very good.
Well, how does an infantryman stop a tank?
Well, the only way you can really stop a tank is if you haven't got an anti-tank gun, you've got to somehow get near enough to it to throw something in the tracks. And that was done quite a bit. They got something and blew the track off, and that immobilised the tank. But it's not easy for infantrymen, of course. There's no way you can get anything into the tank. The tank's a bit of an infantryman's dread.